I had these obsessive desires and thoughts wanting to control them, to, I don't know how to put it, possess them permanently. Not because I was angry with them, not because I hated them, but because I wanted to keep them with me. And as my obsession grew, I was saving body parts such as skulls and skeletons. It's a process. It doesn't happen overnight. When you depersonalize another person and view them as just an object for pleasure instead of a living, breathing human being, it seems to make it easier to do things you shouldn't do. I always knew that it was wrong, but after the first killing was not planned. I was coming back from the shopping mall back in 78. I had had fantasies about picking up a hitchhiker and taking him back to the house and having complete control and dominance over him. No one had a clue as to what was happening for over a decade. It just wasn't an opportunity to fully express what I wanted to do. There was just not the physical opportunity to do it then. And I started, when I moved to Milwaukee in 81, I started reading pornography, going to the bookstores. Eventually that led to frequenting the gay bars. And then one time I brought this young man back to the hotel room, the Ambassador Hotel. Was just planning on drugging him and spending the night with him. Had no intention of hurting him. When I woke up in the morning, he had a broken rib here. I was heavily bruised. Apparently, I had beaten him to death with my fists. At the time, it was almost addictive. It was almost a surge of energy. I wouldn't have to worry about any of their needs or anything. I just had complete control. My way of remembering their appearance, their physical beauty. I also wanted to keep something. If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons. And I even went so far as planning on setting up an altar with the 10 different skulls and skeletons as a sort of memorial, a point where I could, I don't know, it's so bizarre and strange, it's hard to describe, a place where I could collect my thoughts and feed my obsession. I go to the nightclubs, drink, watch the striptease shows, and if I didn't meet anyone at the bars, I'd go to the bath clubs and meet someone there, offer them money, and we'd go back to the apartment, have a few drinks. I'd have the sleeping pill mixture already prepared. Person would drink it, fall asleep. And that's when they would be strangled. I had tried to overcome the thoughts, and it worked for a while, but eventually I gave in. I wish I could say that it just left completely, but no, there are times when I still do have the old compulsions. I started having these obsessive thoughts when I was about 15 and 16, and they got worse and worse. They were sexual fantasies of control, power, complete dominance. They became reality. I was branching out. That's when the cannibalism started, eating of the heart and the arm muscle. It was a way of making me feel that they were a part of me. At first it was just curiosity, and then it became compulsive. Then I tried to keep the person alive by inducing a zombie-like state, by injecting first a dilute acid solution into their brain, or hot water, and it never did completely work. I was dead set on going with this compulsion. It was the only thing that gave me any satisfaction. I kept the mummified head and skull of one of the victims in a carrying case in my locker at work. But that's how strong the compulsion was. That's how bizarre the desire was. I wanted to keep something of the person with me. To this day, I don't know what started it. And the person to blame is sitting right across from you. That's the only person. Not parents, not society, not pornography. I mean, those are just excuses. It was the night of the arrest. I have no memory of what happened during the 6 hours before the last victim ran out of the apartment. I heard a knock on the door, and the police were there with the last victim. They asked me where the key was to the handcuffs. My mind was in a haze. I sort of pointed to the bedroom, and that's where they found the pictures. And they yelled, "Cuff him." And I was handcuffed. And it was just the realization that there was no point in trying to hide my actions anymore. The best route was to help the police identify all the victims and just make a complete confession.
Two of you don't talk a lot about everything that happened, about the crimes in particular.
No, we don't discuss that because it's been gone over so thoroughly in the papers and in the media that there's just really no point in going in depth into any in-depth talks about it. We talk about our family, home, how things used to be, what prison life is here, is like here now, and try to keep things as light and upbeat as possible.
Is it hard for you to go back and talk about those things?
No, not the good things. In fact, it gives me a sense of comfort to talk about the few good times there were in the past.
You say the few good times. Do you think of your childhood as having been profoundly unhappy?
No, not profoundly. My childhood wasn't filled with any great tragedies or anything. There were good times and there were bad times. I think it was fairly normal.
Jeff, do you remember your earliest experience and earliest interest, fascination with the inside of animals? Where that came from?
In ninth grade, in biology class, we had the usual dissection of fetal pigs. I took the remains of that home and kept the skeleton of it. And I just started branching out, dogs, cats. I suppose it could have turned into a normal hobby like taxidermy, but it didn't. It veered off into this. Why, I don't know. All I know is that I wanted to see what the insides of these animals looked like.
Was there some pleasure in the cutting open of the animal?
Yes, there was. No sexual pleasure, but just it's hard to describe.
sense of power, sense of control?
I suppose that's a good way of putting it, yeah.
I can sort of see a fascination for, you know, wanting to see or for looking at the insides of animals, say for the first time. After you did it one time, what more is to be gained by looking at another dog's inside, the second or the third?
I don't know. That became a compulsion, and it switched from animals to humans. I still don't understand it. I don't know why.
What would you do with the dead animals, Jeff? You would pick the carcasses up from the road and take them back into the woods.
Take them back in the woods, skin them sometimes, slit them all the way open, look at the organs, feel them. There was a sort of general excitement for me. I don't know why. It was exciting to see.
One of your dad's biggest questions is when you began to slip away, when you crossed over into this world of obsession or dark fantasy from which you just couldn't return. Can you pinpoint that? Is there a sense for when that really began to happen with you, Jeff?
I think it was around age 14 or 15. Started having obsessive thoughts of violence intermingled with sex. And it just got worse and worse. I didn't know how to tell anyone about it, so I didn't. I just kept it all inside.
Do you have any sense for where that was coming from?
No. No, I've talked with a few psychologists about it. They have their theories, but they don't have any concrete answers either.
Do you have a theory?
No, not really. I don't know where it came from. I probably will never know. But I never dreamed that it would become a reality.
Comprehend. What was it, Jeff, that took you over the edge, do you think, and made you take this from the world of fantasy into reality?
From 15 on, I had this reoccurring fantasy of meeting a hitchhiker on the road, and of taking him hostage and doing what I wanted with him. About 3 years later, I was 18 years old, driving home. I saw this hitchhiker about a mile from my house. Thought to myself, should I stop and pick him up, or should I just keep on going? I wish I just kept on going, but I didn't. I turned around, picked him up, and that's when the nightmare became a reality. It just seemed so bizarre to me that this obsession that I had been thinking about and wanting, just all the parts are there, and they make it possible to make it happen.
What happened after you took him to the house?
The house was empty. My mother was up in Chippewa Falls with her family, and my dad was living in a rented motel about 5 miles away due to the divorce. And I pretty much had the place to myself. I was drinking a lot during that time, and just I don't know, looking for something to some way to find some fulfillment, some pleasure. And I acted on my fantasies, and that's where everything went wrong.
This was the summer of 1978 when you took your first victim.
Right. Once it happened the first time, it just seemed like it had control of my life from there on in. The second occurrence was 1984, roughly. And I met this guy at one of the bars, downtown Milwaukee bars. We went back to the hotel. Just planning on getting drunk, I had put some sleeping pills in his drink to render him unconscious. And was just going to spend the night with him. When I woke up in the morning, my forearms were bruised, and his chest was was bruised and blood was coming out of his mouth. He was hanging over the side of the bed. And I have no memory of beating him to death, but I must have. And that's when it all started again.
And once it started again, you found it impossible to stop.
Right, that's when the obsession went into full swing.
Did you ever tell yourself, I have to stop this? I must stop doing this?
Yes.
When it was going on?
After the second time, it seemed like the compulsion to do it was too strong, and I didn't even try to stop it after that. But before the second time, things had been building up gradually, going to bookstores, going to the bars, the gay bars, bath clubs. When that wasn't enough, buying sleeping pills and using it on various guys in the bath clubs, it just escalated slowly but surely. And after the second time, which was not planned, it was out of control. Felt like it was out of control.
Where did sex enter in to the killings, Jeff?
It was a big part of it. My only objective was to find the best looking guy that I could. Their sexual preference didn't matter to me.
Did their race matter to you?
No, their race didn't matter to me. The first two young men were white. The third young man was American Indian. The fourth and fifth were Hispanic. So no, race had nothing to do with it. It was just their looks.
Was there something sexual in the dismemberment of the bodies for you?
As time went on, yes, I did get a. There was a sexual part to that. I started saving the skeletons and preserving other parts. And one thing led to another. It took more and more deviant type behaviors to satisfy my urges, and so it just spiraled out of control.
Why the cannibalism?
It made me feel like they were a permanent part of me. Besides the just mere curiosity of what it would be like, it made them feel that they were a part of me, and it gave me a sexual satisfaction to do that.
Was it the killing that excited you, or is it what happened after the killing?
No, the killing was just a means to an end. That was the least satisfactory part. I didn't enjoy doing that. That's why I tried to create living zombies with muriatic acid in the drill, but it never worked. No, the killing wasn't the objective. I just wanted to have the person under my complete control, not having to consider their wishes, being able to keep them there as long as I wanted. It's not easy to say that, but that's what the motive was.
Where did that need for control come from? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. Maybe I felt I had no control as a child or young adult, and that got mixed in with my sexuality, and I ended up doing what I did was my way of feeling in complete control, at least for that situation, creating my own little world where I had the final say, finding the best looking guy that I could, and having total mastery over him for as long as I wanted. Lust played a big part of it, controlling lust. That was the motive right there.
A lot of this came out in the course of the trial. Obviously, both of you sat through this. Have the two of you sat down and talked about these things before?
No, not in depth.
This is the first time you're talking about these things with your dad
about
here.
At great length with psychiatrists, court-appointed psychiatrists, psychologists, but not with my family.
We learned everything at the trial and in the confessions and that sort of thing after the fact.
The two of you never really communicated all that much, did you, father and son?
Not on any deep level, no. We talked about superficial things. Never really had a real deep heart-to-heart talk about what was going on inside our own minds. I was always a very private person. I didn't like to open up and share anything with anyone. I liked to keep my thoughts to myself.
Why do you think that was?
Because from about 15 years on up, a great deal of my thoughts were basically unshareable with anyone. So I just closed myself off and put on a mask of normalcy.
You've read the book.
Right.
He called it a father's story, pretty simple title.
Right.
Not a simple story, though.
No, not a simple story. Not one that was easy for me to read. But I'm glad he wrote it.
Did it hurt? Was it painful to read?
Yes, it was painful. Some parts of it were, for me, were even fun to read. There were good parts. It wasn't all negative.
Was it emotional for you reading the book?
Yes, it was.
Tell me, what kind of feelings did you have reading it?
Deep regret, sorrow. I guess those were the two main emotions.
Is there anything in this book that you strongly disagree with?
Yes, I disagree with the description of me as being so incredibly shy and introverted, because maybe that's the way my dad saw me, because there was so much tension in the home that I really didn't feel like being up and happy a lot of the times. But with my friends in school, I had a good time. We had good, you know, good social life, and so I wasn't so extremely reclusive and self-centered as it portrays me.
Does it surprise you to hear Jeff say that he doesn't think of himself and never did as innately shy?
It did surprise me. Maybe my perception was accentuated to the extreme.
But you do recall at age six that you became more aware of tensions in the home.
Oh yeah, that's the time I really remember noticing that things weren't quite right.
So it wasn't so much innate shyness as it was wanting to withdraw from tension and arguments and problems in the house.
That's how I saw it, yeah. I sort of lived in my own little fantasy world when things got too heated in the household. And I carried that over for years, I guess.
And was there violence in that fantasy world?
No, not
early on?
Not the type that showed itself later, no. It was just my own little world where I had control.
Was anger a part of it for you, Jeff?
I had some anger. Probably every kid has some anger, you know, about their childhood. It really wasn't a terrible childhood, though. You know, there were a lot of good times. It wasn't a really terrible time.
So Pat theories about you as a serial killer striking out to get back at your dad, for
all,
instance, don't
all
ring
baloney.
For you.
No, that has no truth in it. The only motive that there ever was to completely control a person that I found physically attractive, and keep them with me as long as possible, even if it meant just keeping a part of them.
Did you know before you read this book that your dad had his own obsessions and fantasies, that he had thought about, that he had dreamed of committing murder, that he had had an obsession with fire and with explosives?
No, that's... I don't think that's the type of thing one asks one's dad.
Were you surprised to read that about your dad?
Very surprised. Yeah. I didn't know what to think about it. I suppose everyone has their secret thoughts, and so it was somewhat of a shock.
You feel grateful that your father wrote this book? Or do you feel put off by it? I mean, I'm just curious about your overall reaction to it. Do you feel is the book an invasion, do you think? Or is it...
No, I feel nothing but pride for him for writing the book and having the courage to bare his soul when he didn't have to. He didn't have to get involved with trying to, you know, help me out and support me and be an emotional support for me, and I'll be grateful to him forever for it.
Did you ever consider talking to your parents, to your dad, about homosexuality? Is that something that you felt you could ever raise?
Early on, I really didn't know that much about it myself. All I knew was that it was something that was to be kept hush-hush, not talked about, not even thought about. So I just kept it all within me and never talked about sexual issues at all, really, with anybody.
Do you think if you had been able to talk about that in a more open way with your dad, for instance, that it would have helped, might have broken this veil of secrecy and enabled you to keep yourself from going down that road?
I don't know exactly what, if anything, would have ever kept me from going down that road. Talking about it, I don't think would have made that much difference, because, like I said, there were things going on in my head that I would have never opened up and talked about with anybody.
Your dad says he never realized how deeply troubled you were, because he just thought you were shy the way he had been, shy as a boy. Do you think the signs were there and he just missed them?
No, I don't think so. Because I had thoughts, I had fantasies, but there was no outward show of anything that was wrong.
You were pretty good at keeping it all inside.
Right, I kept it inside, didn't share any of my thoughts or emotions with anybody.
So how would I ever know?
No, you never saw any of it, as far as I know.
I did not really hear from anyone about any of these activities. And that's what really strikes me now, is if I would have known, what would I have done about it? I think I would have done a lot about it.
I feel it's wrong for people who commit crimes to try to shift the blame onto somebody else, onto their parents or onto their upbringing or living circumstances. I think that's just a cop-out. And my parents, my relatives, had no knowledge of what I was doing. They're absolutely not responsible for any of it in any way, and I take full responsibility.
But you understand that what you did would lead your father to ask himself all kinds of questions.
That's true.
Where did I go wrong? Was there something I could have said or done to have prevented this?
Right.
Did I in some way create or contribute to the terrible acts my son committed?
I understand that. I just get angry with other people who think that they have a right to somehow try to blame my parents for what happened. That's not right at all. No one has the right to do that, because they're totally innocent. They had no knowledge of it. And that angers me.
But parents, just naturally, I mean, any parent that really cares, they just first of all say, I feel guilty. You know, there's just feelings of guilt. What happened? What did I do? What could I have done? And so that's a normal parental reaction.
Your dad has wondered about all kinds of things, from the medication that your mom was on during her pregnancy, to the fact that you were exposed to violent arguments in the home from an early age and continuing, to the possibility that he might have passed on some genetic propensity for obsession or violent behavior. Does any of that ring true to you?
I can see why he'd wonder about those things, but as far as I'm concerned, they're all excuses, because I didn't feel accountable to anybody. I didn't feel that I had to face what I had done ever. And so there comes a point where a person has to be accountable for what he's done. Can't go around making excuses, blaming other people or other things. So I alone am the one who's responsible for what's happened.
Let me ask, when did you first feel that everyone is accountable for their actions?
Well, thanks to you for sending that creation science material, because I always believe the lie that evolution is truth, the theory of evolution is truth, that we all just came from the slime, and when we died, you know, that was it. There was nothing. So the whole theory cheapens life, and started reading books about how that show how evolution is just a complete lie. There's no basis in science to uphold it, and I've since come to believe that that the Lord Jesus Christ is the true creator of the heavens and the earth. It just didn't just happen, and I've accepted him as my Lord and Savior, and I believe that I, as well as everyone else, will be accountable to him.
Growing up, did you feel that you were accountable to your dad or to your mom as the authority figure in the house?
Yes, I did. I mean, they didn't let me run wild. They disciplined me. And so I felt accountable to them. But afterwards, after I left the home, that's when I started wanting to sort of create my own little world where I could be the one who had the complete control, where I didn't have to bow to anyone else's demands, and I just took it way too far.
Lionel?
At that period of time, I had drifted away from a belief in a supreme being, and I never, as a result, passed along the feeling that we are all accountable in the end. He owns us. And that basic concept is very fundamental to all of us.
You feel that the absence, at least for a while, of a strong religious faith and belief
for some years
may have prevented you from instilling some of that in Jeff.
That's right.
Is that how you feel?
Yes, I think I had a big part to do with it. I mean, if a person doesn't think that there is a God to be accountable to, then what's the point of trying to modify your behavior to keep it within acceptable ranges? That's how I thought, anyway. And I've since come to believe that the Lord Jesus Christ is truly God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. They're the only true God.
What do you remember about your parents arguing when you were growing up, and what effect that had on you?
It was unnerving, depressing, made me angry sometimes. I'd leave the house, go out in the woods, and sulk, brooding, you know, wondering why they had to have such a rough relationship. Most of the time they didn't seem to get along too well together. I never knew what the real underlying problems were. I didn't feel it was my place to ask.
Did you blame one or the other? Mom
no,
or dad?
No. No, I didn't. I was just frustrated that things couldn't be happier around the house.
You just wanted things to be more peaceful.
Right. Right. I never saw any real violent arguments as far as physical hitting or anything like that, but there was a lot of yelling, a lot of tension in the house sometimes.
One of the chilling stories that your dad tells is about the box he had found. Can you give me your perspective on that?
I had a box in my bedroom closet, and It contained the mummified head and genitals of a young man I met in one of the bars down in Milwaukee. And it was a locked metal box. My dad 1 week came to visit and happened to see it, and we got into a bit of an argument because I wouldn't open it up. He took the locked box down to the basement and was about to smash it open.
What were you thinking as he was making his way downstairs to open the box?
Well, I was outside, and I was thinking, I've got to stop this from happening. I didn't know what I'd do or say. I didn't know what would happen. I thought, you know, it's all going to come crashing down now. And but the box was never opened, not in my dad's presence. And so the lies continued. The whole scenario just continued for years after that.
Were there times when your dad may have been closer to discovering what was going on than even he knew? Times where you got worried that maybe he would find something out?
The box incident was about as close as it came, yeah. That was just one incident. There were others. But that was a particularly nerve-wracking one.
Are there others you can share? Other close calls?
When acidified, dissolved human remains were found, they didn't look like human remains anymore, but they were in the trash bin outside in the garage. That was one incident. And a few others I'd rather not go into right now.
Were you relieved to be arrested?
Part of me was, and part of me wasn't.
Explain.
I don't know. It's like I don't believe I have a split personality, but you know the feeling where you're sort of glad about something, but on the other hand, you're not. That's how it was. It was a relief not to have to keep such a gigantic secret that I had kept for so many years. And once I saw that I had no choice but to face it, I decided to face it head on and make a full confession. So I am glad that the secrets are gone.
Your father told me that one of the reasons he wrote this book was in order to put down on paper what he has been unable to say to you in words, kind of reaching out to you. What do you want to say to him, having read this?
I tell you, Dad, I'm really sorry that this has happened, and I love you a lot.
I love you, too.
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry.
We haven't always shown it a lot, but I do love him a great deal.
I love you.
And without the support of my folks, I don't think I would have come through this. We've opened up with each other a lot more now since the trial and everything. There's no secrets to be hidden away. You know, I don't feel that I have to keep any secrets from him. We've come to face what's real now instead of just glossing things over and talking about superficial things. So there's a lot more communication between us.
This book may serve as a further bridge between Jeff and myself. And just for that purpose, I regard it as valuable for me.
Do you feel closer to your dad having read this?
I feel closer in that I understand more how he was thinking, what his thoughts were, what some of his motivations were. I'm glad he wrote it.
Anything not in the book you want to say to him?
I can't think too clearly right now. I'm feeling pretty emotional. I think that a lot of things have been brought out in this interview that has brought us to a little bit deeper, just a little bit closer understanding as to how this all originated. And well, whenever I get emotional, my analytical side gets clouded, and I can't express myself quite as much as well as I would like.
Can you talk about the feelings you have? You feeling close to Jeff?
I feel very close to Jeff, and it's going to continue till our death. And I feel good about it.
Do you think you'll ever have the answers you've been looking for about why, what happened, and what role, if any, you played?
Maybe not. With my primary question is the origins of it. And if something can be learned about that, it may help other people avert problems.
Is it still there, Jeff? Does it ever go away?
In part, no, it never completely goes away. I'll probably have to live with it for the rest of my life. I wish it would go away. I wish there was some way to completely get rid of the compulsive thoughts, the feelings. It's not nearly so bad now that there's no avenues to actually act on it. But no, it never seems to go completely away.
So the thoughts still come to you?
Sometimes, yeah.
Are you different, Jeff, in terms of how you think back on all of this?
I would hope I'm different. I'm glad that I'm in a position now where I don't feel the compulsion to do these things. I'm glad that it's over. Any words I say to the victims' families are just going to seem trite and empty. I don't know how to express the regret, the sorrow. That I feel for what I've done for their sons. I can't find the right words.